Welcome to another edition of Get Lit with Literature. This is Monk. Oh, this is a fabulously written book, devastating and thought-provoking to read. It's already gotten a lot of review. I saw like NPR, Fresh Air, and Wall Street Journal. So some major mainstream outlets are covering it. The question is, how much change will it affect? Cobalt Red, How the Blood of the Congo Powers Our Lives, Siddharth Kara, St. Martin's Press. Now, I was mentally prepared for this book, having read Eduardo Galeano's classic Open Veins of Latin America, 5 centuries of the pillage of a continent, and then Tom Burgess's The Looting Machine, which is also about Africa. But I was not prepared emotionally, and the Zen koan of the title, the conundrum of disparity. In essence, cobalt, and 75% of it that comes from the Congo, mined much of it in what are called artisanal miners, which is not like an artisanal bread maker. It's sort of a euphemism, but compared to industrial mining, these are children, whether digging in the dirt or in tunnels, many children and older, slave, if not torture, or with the way the bosses are, mafioso labor, or including debt bondage. At one time, the author refers to it as a killing field. Now, this is a cobalt that is in every smartphone, and that why all of a sudden there's been copper has been mined. That was part of King Leopold in the history in the, I think, late 1800s and early 1900s. The Belgian sociopath, King Leopold, there was lots of copper involved, but that was before there was a need for cobalt, which is also a main ingredient for the push for the electric vehicles and other batteries. So the whole idea of green and sustainable is nonsense, because as the book Cobalt Red shows, the mining causes, not only is there destruction of forest and cutting down of trees, but pollution of rivers from the mining. So habitats, you know, toxic residue are destroyed, and slave or torture labor, children working 12-hour days to fill a sack of with ore that has part of the cobalt that gets shipped up the supply chain, and they make, you know, a buck or two a day that it goes to the mega corporations. A lot of it goes through China, the Chinese mining companies, and the whole the mining, because it's not industrial, the way they can trace it is really not exactly traceable. And all these big corporations that, you know, Apple, Samsung, whomever, they say that they care about the workers and they care about fair treatment, and maybe they can cite the supply chain. But according to this book, that is just not true. That is not completely true. Maybe they do some of it, but the treatment of these children and the way it's produced and the lack of basic wages, safety equipment, medical care. I mean, it's not even working. It makes working a minimum wage job at fast food look like, working in a palace. So the conundrum of disparity is that the West, in Europe and the West and wherever else, we have to have these cell phones, we have to have these gadgets, we have to have them. So while I'm reading this book, it really makes me scratch my head and say, do we have to have them? Or at the least, there could be a fair treatment. Why does there have to be such abuse swept under the rug so that, you know, most of us can enjoy our slick gadgets? Now, there's a point in the book where he mentions the children, they've never seen a smartphone. So it's very poignant. The author, he actually, in the acknowledgments, the last of the acknowledgments pages, above all, my beloved wife, Aditi, carried this heavy burden with me and gracefully absorbed all that it did to me. I was at times heartbroken, angry, and shell-shocked by what I witnessed in the Congo. Her love and strength carried me through every step of this journey. I would have never crawled out of the darkness without her. Now, this author, he braved his life. He, you know, he went in. He got as much people to question and interview as possible. He went to the mines, and a lot of the places he described, these mines are guarded by soldiers. So what this showed me, stuff that I've been aware of, but it really showed me how basically the entire global economy is fascist. It's a blending of the corporations and the state-sanctioned. These things could not happen if the government in the Congo was not okaying it. And then it's propped up by violence, or the threat of violence, with militia and armies guarding these places and these mines and such like, and kids threatened if they didn't do their job. I mean, it really is disturbing. So if you're going to read this kind of book, you have to be prepared for that. And this is all, again, the cobalt is one of, so this is just one piece of the puzzle, but one of the main ingredients, necessary ingredients in especially the car batteries and smartphones. I don't know, like when I went to buy a new vacuum after using the same one for 20, maybe 22 years, 21 years, that almost all of them had lithium batteries. I think I may have found one that didn't, but what it makes me do personally is question the usage. I had people somewhat badgering me. I had a little dinky cell phone for many, many years, and people were badgering me to get another cell phone. And after reading this book, it's like, it proves my point. Hey, I'm trying to at least minimize my footprint with that stuff. So what do we do? That's the question it raises. How is it possible to balance the economy that most of us live in and are used to with its virtual opposite, if not its literal opposite? I mean, less usage is one. That is one. Less usage. Less up, you know, I don't keep up with it, but how many times do I see the phone, you know, this phone number 12, number 13, number 14? I mean, why do they have to keep upgrading and making better and more? What is the freaking point when how do you balance that with destruction of the land, the trees, pollution of the forests, the rivers, and the labor to do that? I mean, that's just as blunt and as I can sum up this book. So that's how powerful it is. It really has me thinking that way. Yeah, here he's again, it's very well written. A lone girl stood atop a dome of dirt, hands on her hips, eyes cast long across the barren land where giant trees once ruled. Her gold and indigo sarong fluttered wildly in the wind as she surveyed the ruin of people and earth. Beyond the horizon, beyond all reason and morality, people from another world awoke and checked their smartphones. None of the artisanal miners I met in Kipushi had ever seen one. And then there's depots, the depots, all these places that the rocks go, the rocks and the ore go up the supply chain. And this is nothing new. This is the history, much of the history of Africa. And quite amazingly, at one point it mentions 400 treaties made with the native peoples. Now that's the number that I often hear. It has to do with the treaties that the U.S. has made, and not one of them have they kept with the native peoples of Turtle Island. 400. That's not an exact number, but I just found that astounding. Which again proves to me that the whole global system is based on colonialism and capitalism, and it's rotten to the core. But we are so hooked into using the gadgets, and you know, driving places to get to do the lifestyles. So aside from just none of that, I mean, how can that get minimized? And here's some of this history. By what processes then were the natives of the Congo being induced to labor, since commerce apparently played no part in the affair? Morrell recalled the reports of atrocities submitted by missionaries and concluded that the Congo Free State was operating by virtue of, quote, the reduction of millions of men to a condition of absolute slavery by a system of legalized robbery enforced by violence, end quote. Now that goes back a ways to the late 1800s and 1900. And for literary fans, an interesting case, the Congo Reform Association became the first international human rights organization of the 20th century. Driven by the power of data, morrell, and survivor testimonies, another author named Casement, Joseph Conrad, Arthur Conan Doyle, Mark Twain, and Booker T. Washington were among the many supporters of the CRA. By 1908, Leopold was forced to sell the Congo Free State to the Belgian government, bringing an end to one of the most brazen systems of slavery in the history of Africa, or so it seemed. Leopold showed the world that the Congo was teeming with riches. The minerals in Katanga had only recently been prospected. When the Belgian government took over, the scramble was on. So again, the history has not changed. And further history was, there was something called the Berlin Conference in 1884, which was the deliberate plotting of the divvying up of Africa. You can look that up. My other notes have there's a whole smoke screen around the supply chain, like a deliberate smoke screen from these child miners up to these depots that then ship how it goes up the chain and eventually gets to China or wherever it goes, other places too. It's confusing. And then the one glimpse of solution, if I had heard of his name and mildly aware of him, was Patrice Lumumba. I think he was president of the Congo for a few years, until Patrice Lumumba offered a fleeting chance at a different fate, but the neo-colonial machinery of the West chopped him down and replaced him with someone who would keep their riches flowing. Cobalt is but the latest treasure they have come to loot. Another example of the conundrum of disparity. Imagine for a moment the toll taken on a person, a family, a people, a continent across centuries of the slave trade, followed by a century of colonization. Empires were built and generations of wealth were amassed across the Western world in this manner. Perhaps that is the most enduring contrast of all between our world and theirs. Our generally safe and satisfied nations can scarcely function without forcing great violence upon the people of Africa. The catastrophe in the mining provinces of the Congo is the latest chapter in this unholy tale. So that is the gist. It's the Congo and the cobalt is one example of the larger picture, the larger conundrum of this whole system, this whole capitalist colonial system of 500 plus years. Just built on atrocities and genocide and the rape and the destruction of the lands and the air and the water. So when you step back, this book makes me step back and think, like, how insane is it? Like, how insane is it that do we not stop and think about, is it worth chopping down trees and polluting water to have our gadgets? I don't know that that's the equation, but that's what it makes me think. And here's an example of the fascism, the merger of corporate and state. The informal and all but untraceable nature of the marketplace made it impossible to discriminate the source of cobalt once it was thrown into the same batch of acids for processing industrially mined ore. What else could the purpose of this kind of remote night marketplace be other than to launder artisanally mined cobalt into the formal supply chain, completely out of view and certainly beyond the scope of any tracing or auditing of cobalt supply chains that were purportedly taking place? Can any company at the top of the chain legitimately suggest that the cobalt in their devices or cars did not pass through a village marketplace like this? The deeper I ventured into the mining provinces, the murkier the bottom of the cobalt supply chain proved to be, and the more resistant to claims that the flow of cobalt was adequately monitored for child labor or other abuses. The strained relationship between the residents of Fungurume and the TFM mine was illustrative of a broader crisis unfolding across the mineral provinces of the Congo. Foreign mining companies expropriated large swaths of land, displaced villagers, contaminated the environment, offered little to no support to the local population, and left them to eke out a meager existence in dangerous conditions as artisanal miners on the land they once lived on. And perhaps, you know, I'm not reading these things to make anybody feel guilty. I don't think that's going to do it. It's just to be aware and think what can be done. Here's another example of the disparity, and about as concise and blunt as can be. The translator from my interviews, Augustine, was distraught after several days of trying to find the words in English that captured the grief being described in Swahili. He would at times drop his head and sob before attempting to translate what was said. As we parted ways, Augustine had this to say: "Please tell the people in your country a child in the Congo dies every day so that they can plug in their phones." And then the further descriptions of just, you know, the dust, the way the pollution, that the babies growing up and the you know, having to breathe, you know, as anybody knows about mining, the conditions are just abhorrent. The women of Fungurumi typically begin their days with the Sisyphean task of wiping away the grit that has settled on their homes overnight. Most of the men in town, such as Frank and his 14-year-old son, Glory, try to sleep in. They are often awake much of the night, digging on the TFM concession. I met Frank and Glory in their homes near the northeastern edge of Fungurumi. A thin, pale green sheet was draped over the entrance of the home in place of a front door. Inside, the dwelling consisted of two rooms, one in which Glory, his mother, father, and two younger brothers slept on mats on the dirt, the other in which they cooked, ate, and listened to the radio. Although some of the homes in Fungurumi had spotty electricity, theirs did not. They bought batteries to power their flashlights and radio. The price of the batteries was more expensive than I would have imagined. $2, roughly one day's income for a pack of four AA batteries. Price seemed particularly exorbitant since they were living right next to one of the largest battery component metal-making mines in the world. So there's the blatant hypocrisy and the disparity. And another historical parallel is that since many native people cite 1492 as the turning point, there is no single starting point, least of all in a land with such an epic and tragic past as the Congo. But if we were to try to identify a place and time that we might call the beginning of this journey, we might settle on the mouth of the Congo River in the year 1482. And then further on, he describes along with Columbus, other so-called discoverers. Following this discovery, an explorer named Diego Cao, C-A-O, sailed farther south than any European yet and set anchor in Loango Bay near the mouth of the Congo River in 1482. The age of invasion completed its tragic reconnaissance in the global south when Christopher Columbus reached the Americas in 1492 and Vasco da Gama sailed around Africa to India in 1498. So also as far as the book and the writing, you get the big picture and the little picture. You get the microcosm of the families and the children, and then you get the context in which all this happens, which, you know, helps to understand the smaller one, the microcosm. And here it is. By early 1884, Stanley had secured more than 400 treaties from native tribes amassing a massive stretch of land across the Congo. None of the tribal leaders fully understood that they were ceding authority to their lands to the AIC, and they certainly could not read the language in which the agreement was written. Nevertheless, Leopold had what he needed to make the case that the Congo was his at an imperialist extravaganza called the Berlin Conference. On November 15, 1884, the major colonial powers of Europe convened in Berlin to discuss how they might carve up Africa. Now, oftentimes when you read the news and you read that and people wonder, oh, is it incompetence or is this stuff deliberate? Well, there's one of your answers. The 1884, the major colonial powers of Europe convened in Berlin to discuss how they might carve up Africa. Leopold's emissaries presented the territories of the AIC as a free trade zone and stipulated that the Congo River would remain open for shipping without tariffs. Conference ended with the General Act of Berlin, which set out the terms of the European dissection of Africa. I recently saw that there was some kind of grain exporting of grain from Ukraine. which is one of the underlying reasons for that war there, so the agribusinesses can take over the very rich land. So it's the same kind of cycle and the same pattern wherever you look. Basically, it's a fascist mafioso government corporate business world out there, sadly. So as far as the cell phone, I had one, T-Mobile, which I don't know the services that well, but I like their service. Basically, it's good enough for me. But that one, they canceled the phone. It was like, I think it was 3G. And so at a certain point, I had to keep up with that, I had to get another. I think I got a Samsung. I don't even know if that's a smartphone. I guess it is. It was one of the cheapest ones. I couldn't believe how much they cost. I just use it for texting and calls and some photos, maybe some videos. But that's, the video stuff is a bonus. I didn't even get it for that. But I had to get it. Why did I have to get it? Because the companies are driving the consumer interest by upgrading to the whatever the 4G, and now they're threatening to do 5 and 6 and who knows what else. But they are driving the economy to force people to spend more money so they can make more money. And then the other part of the equation is the society and the consumers that go along with it. So that's why this book is just, I think it's, you know, an essential book for these times, for understanding what's going on, and presumably it'll help make a difference. Presumably it'll raise awareness and at least to give fair treatment to the people that work. I mean, gosh, you know, just, you know, how could you enjoy a meal? And I mean, if you went to a restaurant and you heard the waiter, you heard the chef being whipped and screaming by the owner of the restaurant to bring you a delicious meal, how could you enjoy that? So what has happened to our consciousness that we are able to, I guess it's that cognitive dissonance thing, we are able to, the immediacy of that kind of thing is lost in the global supply chain, so that we can think about it, but it's not a direct thing. Like if I went to a restaurant like that, would I be back the next night to eat? I don't think so. Even if I was starving, I don't think so. So how do we make that? It's like the mechanicalness and the technology, that consciousness and the greed has taken over some of our consciousness to the point where we just let it slide. I mean, no fault. This is not a criticism or pointing out any fault, but just to a reflection of things. A handful of people that I mentioned the book to, and I mentioned it in a quick conversation, that they kind of wince because they're aware of the mistreatment and the imbalance. But then it's kind of like, you know, but what are you going to do? I need the gadget to call somebody, or to purchase something, or to get somewhere, or to pay a bill, or whatever. So again, it's a big conundrum of the whole way that we're being roped into this system where we're dependent on this stuff. When, I mean, I grew up, you know, without this stuff. I mean, I have heard, say, Native people talk about how they grew up, or you know, they experienced clean rivers and they could drink from the river. And, you know, maybe there were some places like that near me when I was growing up. But as a city kid, I was not much aware of all that. But I can certainly say, and I do say it to younger people now, like, oh, yeah, when I went to summer camp, I wrote a letter every week or whatever it was. It wasn't like, oh, hi, I'm in the bus now and we're 10 minutes from when I left, and then I'll call you in 20 minutes and I'll text you in 40 minutes. And you know, it's like nothing like that. So if we as a people could have survived without all that stuff, where are we now? I mean, and maybe we're too far gone into the system that everything runs on this stuff, that we, at some level, we are dependent on it. But, you know, as they say, Mother Earth bats last in the baseball metaphor. Like, how much destruction of the natural world can be done in the feeding of this system. I mean, those are the two major things I see as far as the abhorrence is the treatment down to the level of the bottom of the supply chain and child slave torture labor, and then the literal destruction of the lands and the waters and the pollution of the air. So what kind of system? I think also we need to step back and not just address, obviously the day-to-day is an essence to the people dealing with it, address those, but we also need to look at the bigger picture in the global economical picture, but then also even in the bigger picture from the earth and sky perspective of what kind of system have we wrought and how long do we think we can maintain that? Thank you for listening and be well.